You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After 9/11, hundreds of the residents of Brooklyn's Little Pakistan neighborhood were detained, questioned, and sometimes harassed by the government. And in many cases, they turned for help to the Council of People's Organization, which was founded by Mohammad Razvi. In an article called Neighborhood Watched, New Yorker staff contributor Jennifer Gottman profiles Mr. Razvi and the work that he's doing to defend his community. It's in the latest issue of the magazine and brings both Jennifer Gottman and Mohammad Razvi to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mohammad, the subtitle of Jennifer's article is Little Pakistan Persevered After 9/11. Can it survive in the age of Trump? During the 2016 election, were people in your community concerned with what then candidate Donald Trump was saying about Muslims?
Absolutely. I mean, many community members, especially the mosque next to me, were rallying even outside that, you know, we need to make sure that we vote and to show our, support and make sure that we have a wonderful president.
Has the fear escalated since his inauguration and the executive order on immigration?
Absolutely. I mean, right after the inauguration, my daughter, she's 10 years old, and she was like almost in tears. More importantly, the community was so much in fear.
Have things calmed down a bit since the rejection of the executive order by the courts?
Things did calm down, but then you hear that he's thinking of having another order. And recently, we're finding out many individuals who had orders of stay when they went to special register back in after 9/11, they're put into deportation proceedings.
When did your family come to New York City from Pakistan?
So my mom and dad, they came somewhere around 1977, and then they brought us, the kids, around sometime in 1980.
You were just a kid.
I was just a kid.
Weren't they escaping from anti-Shia persecution in Pakistan?
They were escaping for prosperity. And I do remember one incident when I was a young boy, where the place where we were, in my uncle's place, and there was a bombing that had happened. It's absolutely...
Still going on.
Things still go on.
Were attitudes about Pakistani immigrants different in the late 70s?
Well, when I was growing up, it was just you barely seen any Pakistanis in the neighborhood. And I was like one of the very few. And it looked like the Pakistanis that were coming over are more educated and, they're more, business oriented or professionals.
I was just wondering whether they were welcomed.
They were welcomed, absolutely.
Jennifer, you begin your article with the story of Tahira Khan, who was helping her son Mansour get ready for school in Midwood, Brooklyn, when she heard a knock on the door.
Yeah, exactly. This is a story, actually, that goes back to 2005. And Shahid Ali Khan, her husband, when the immigration agents come to the door and knock, they have a picture of him. They're looking for him, and they ask her, where is he? And it was early in the morning. And he was a day laborer, had gone off to work. And so they said, give him a call. And when they called, he got the call. He was in a van on his way to New Jersey, going from Brooklyn to New Jersey. And the immigration agents ordered him to come back home. And the van turns around, and he comes back home. And before he even gets into his apartment building, he's cuffed, waist chain, being escorted into a van and ultimately taken off to an immigration detention facility.
Was this partly because attitudes had changed since the time Mohammed's family came here and 2005, when, of course, 2005 is just 4 years after the 9/11 attacks?
Exactly. Mr. Khan and his family had come in 1997. He was a bank manager in Pakistan, and his wife gave birth to a son who turned out to have a heart defect. And the doctors in Pakistan told him, you need to leave the country and get surgery to save the son. And they considered different countries to go to and ultimately got a visa to America. Started at Coney Island Hospital and found their way eventually to Mount Sinai, where when the boy was two, he had open heart surgery and was saved. And yet suffered a rare and extreme complication, a rare movement disorder that meant that he couldn't really control his limbs, couldn't walk, feed
himself.
So
they couldn't go back to Pakistan.
Essentially, they couldn't go back. They had temporary visas and tried to extend them. And ultimately, those efforts were pending at the time that immigration agents came to his door and picked him up.
So did they have a lawyer?
They did.
What happened?
Well, Mr. Rossi can tell the rest of the story, but this is back in...
Because they came to you.
Right, exactly. This is 2005.
Yeah. So prior even to that, Mr. Khan had to special register, as I mentioned earlier. And this was an effort where, under Bush's administration, they were requesting any person who had a visa to come and register with the INS and FBI, because this was a Patriot Act. This was saving the country.
But there were no Pakistanis involved in the 9/11 attacks.
No.
Why has Pakistan been one of the countries that has been singled out?
Well, that's the unfortunate part. At that time, it was actually 25 countries, and Pakistan also was on the list. Out of the 25 countries, 24 countries were Muslims, Muslim countries. And Mr. Khan registered, doing his due diligence, doing the right thing. And when he registered, he was put on a list. Mm-hmm. And that's when he got the knock on the door.
And then his immigration lawyer, Eleanor Drucker Rahmani, suggested that the family speak to you?
Yeah, absolutely, because at that time we were working very, very closely with many people trying to help them.
Why did you start the organization in 2002? Was it a direct response to what happened after 9/11?
Absolutely. So I used to run mom-and-pop store. My dad, he had the first grocery store on the block, and it was just the grocery store and the mosque. As my dad did better, as we did better, I helped them to open other stores. I had a restaurant. I was running a construction company. I had a 99-cent store. And 9/11, when it happened, I was working at my restaurant, and I was building a fabric store. And I had the lease to be a fabric store. And that fabric store became the fabric that held the community together, where my office is now.
But it was a small office. What's it like now?
So it was a 1,000 square foot office, and currently now I have a 20,000 square foot office and also a queen site. But people came to me because they trusted us, and that's the key.
Well, weren't the circumstances of the family, the Khan family and their child Mansour, the sort of thing that outrages people, the fact that there was being a deportation despite the terrible situation for the child? There were newspaper articles?
Yeah, certainly. Newsday was on top of it and did a terrific story, Robert Pullner from Newsday, and I would imagine it played some sort of role in stopping the deportation. And in the end, Mr. Khan spent only 5 days in a detention facility in New Jersey and was then allowed to leave and stay in the country temporarily as long as he checked in every several months or so.
Yeah.
But you went to local politicians, Major Owens, others?
Absolutely. I went to Chuck Schumer's office, and I actually took the mom and took her over there, and then I took her also to Major Owens' office, and I advocated for them. And, I continued. I also was ready to, have a rally for them. And as things moved forward, I actually contacted the deportation officer, and I sent him the news article. And I said, this is what's happening, and I really need you to reconsider. And lo and behold, I receive a phone call. He's going to be released, I think it was 4 days later or something. And I was sitting there beside myself. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. So I actually then called back the Newsday reporter, and I said, you got to come and see this. And then they did another story. And it was such a happy ending.
And it's okay now?
It was okay until about a few weeks ago. So the family was going back and forth every year, just doing a check-in and getting an additional stay. So now it's over, two decades they've been here. I remember Mr. Shahid Ali Khan, he stopped me in the street in Manhattan, and he goes, keep blowing the horn. I didn't know who it was. And he goes, look, I'm driving a yellow cab. I can, I can survive. I can help my family now. Thank you. Thank you. It's all because of you. And his son then brought in a thank you card, and it says, thank you for bringing my dad back. And it was with a picture of him graduating from elementary school. And it just took to my heart. I was just sitting in there in tears, that I could be part of this and help them.
I'm speaking with Mohammad Razvi, executive director and founder of the Council of People's Organization, COPO, and with Jennifer Gonerman of The New Yorker, where she is a staff writer and has been nominated for Pulitzer and all sorts of other awards. Her article is Neighborhood Watched. It's in the current issue of The New Yorker. You say now that since the inauguration of President Trump, you get 10 to 15 calls a day. What are the biggest concerns?
So biggest concern is what's going to happen now? Is he going to come up with another ban? Is he going to come up with this? And Mr. Shahid Ali Khan, when he came into our office, he said, Muhammad, I can't explain to you what has changed at the office at 26 Federal Plaza. All the federal agents have been changed, and no one knows us, and we were treated just like really, really bad.
Jennifer, how large is the Pakistani community in New York City? Can anybody tell? I assume not everybody is admitting to being a member.
I think it's nobody knows exactly how many folks are there. The census numbers, which the city uses to calculate that population, is 73,000 or so of foreign-born Pakistanis and their offspring. But surely the number is quite a bit higher than that. Not everybody on their census forms, you know, fills it out or says exactly where they're from. So nobody knows.
And I'm sure right now, considering the fact that Pakistan is one of the nations that's on that presidential President Trump's list, makes people feel a little more paranoid. But didn't the Immigration Act of 1990 play a role in all of the Pakistani immigration to the United States?
Well, I should just clarify that Pakistan wasn't actually on the travel ban list, but folks in Little Pakistan were frightened that it would be added since it was on sort of pass lists like special registration.
I just keep on making the list bigger and bigger.
Yeah. So
Indonesia isn't on it either, even though that's the that is the country with the largest Muslim population in the world.
So yeah, as you were mentioning, the Immigration Act in 1990 did certainly raise the overall number of visas and is part of the reason why you had the growth of Little Pakistan, which became a real 24-hour hub on Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn between maybe Avenue H and Newkirk.
Yeah, I mean, many people who used to come to Little Pakistan, they'd never seen each other for almost 20 years, and they just met up, and they're like, oh, my God. And, you know, back then, we didn't have Facebook or that much into media and internet connections.
Wasn't it a Jewish neighborhood? How fast did it grow into a Pakistani neighborhood?
So I would say it would be since 1983, from that time on, it just started to grow one after the other. Stores were being taken up by Pakistanis, and the community just flourished. And, I mean, they were doing so well prior to 9/11. But then after 9/11, it just devastated the community.
Stores closed, people left.
Stores shut down, and especially because of the special registration program. Over, you know, many, many stores shut down.
Now, what about that special registration program? That was enacted after 9/11?
That was acted after 9/11, and it really caused the fear within the community because you were damned if you didn't, and you were damned if you did. So they registered over 85,000 individuals throughout the country and put 13,000 of them in deportation proceedings.
You're quoted in the article as saying, women came into Punjab Grocery at all hours, that's your family's grocery, saying that their son or husband had vanished. Many didn't speak English and rarely left the neighborhood. Some of these women for 10, 15 years, that was their four-block radius. That was it.
That was it. And so when we opened up the office, all we had was a sign, ESL classes and legal services. I had 300 people register for ESL classes on one day. Currently, we're still running ESL classes. We have free immigration services. We have the first halal senior center in the U.S., maybe.
Did you, when you called and you said, hi, this is Mohammed Razvi, did that cause problems?
That was a very difficult time because every time, like, for example, Mr. Shahid Ali Khan, when I was advocating for him, whenever I mentioned Mohammed Razvi, there was a brick wall I had to cross over. So I started using Mo Razvi, and it made it easier because then they said, okay, you know what? Okay. And especially when they are hearing Council of People's Organization, okay. They actually thought I was an attorney at them. I'm like,
Morris Razvi.
Mo Razvi, that's it.
My guests are Mohammed Razvi and Jennifer Goneman. We are talking about the events that are described in Jennifer's article in the New Yorker, the current issue of the New Yorker, called Neighborhood Watched, subtitled Little Pakistan persevered after 9/11. Can it survive in the age of Trump? We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Jennifer Garnerman, whose latest article in The New Yorker, where she is a staff writer, is called Neighborhood Watched, Little Pakistan Persevered After 9/11, Can It Survive in the Age of Trump? Featured in that article is Mohammad Razvi, the executive director and founder of Council of People's Organization, also known as COPO. Jennifer, how many immigrants did the FBI arrest after 9/11?
Well, there was a group that came to be known as the 9/11 detainees. These were folks that were arrested and detained, 762 in total, about 500 in New York. The group that we, or the country that was most represented was Pakistan, and over 200 of those folks were Pakistani.
254, you say in the article. Yeah. So did any of those arrests stick? They were arresting people because they thought they were somehow connected to jihadi groups?
Well, the FBI had launched, of course, a massive investigation into the terrorist attacks to try to, you know, find anybody connected to it. But that investigation, when it came to Little Pakistan, and Mr. Razvi can tell you this best, became, you know, a sort of broad dragnet in which anybody, it seemed, that they encountered that was out of status, who was here illegally, got swept into the terror investigation, regardless of whether they had, you know, when they often had, always had nothing to do.
So it was really a matter of overstaying their visas rather than being involved in any potential terrorist activities?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like Shahid Ali Khan or this one individual, I'm holding up his wristband. His name was Erbab. This individual was detained because he was a week and a half late in registering for his college classes. He was picked up, put into a county jail in New Jersey. And he actually was in jail with other inmates who were criminals, who were murderers. And even after the judge had ordered bail for this individual, it took me 12 hours to get him out. Now, if this individual would committed a crime like a murder or something, and if he had set bail, it would probably take me a few hours to get him out. But this is what was happening.
In 2003, the Inspector General of the Justice Department released a report on a group of immigrants who came to be known as the September 11 detainees. And there were a lot of mistakes listed in
they
that?
Basically, Mr. Razvi had been hearing over and over stories about folks being picked up who had absolutely nothing to do with anything terror-related, but were merely sort of just stumbled upon or encountered law enforcement, since there were so many of them in the neighborhood. And you know, he had this line, which I quoted in the story, something along the lines of, if they were looking for Jane Doe, they picked up John Doe. In a sense that folks, that law enforcement was just fishing for anybody to pick up. And then his hunch, which I don't know how many people actually believed you at that time when you told them these stories, but this hunch was borne out when the Inspector General of the Justice Department did a report a year or two later on the September 11th detainees.
And you mentioned that in 2002, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the special registration program that began with five Muslim countries, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, and Sudan, and then was expanded to 25, including Pakistan. In a short period of time, 82,000 men were registered nationwide. How many were being deported?
Over 13,000 put in deportation proceedings.
And it was the grounds were just simply that they'd overstayed their visas?
Or questionable visas. Basically, they didn't check in, or they didn't check in and they had moved. So it was multiple things. It didn't make any difference. They just wanted to put people into that position.
And then you report that people who stayed behind often suffered other kinds of problems, like your daughter, Asma.
So here is the discrimination book after 9/11, which I did with the Human Rights Commission and Mayor Bloomberg at that time.
That's a book filled with a lot of papers.
It's a three-ring binder. It's overflowing here.
And hundreds and hundreds of cases, and one of them was my daughter's case, where children who were harassed, and that's what one of the most things that frustrated me, because these kids were really, really victims, and they had no place to really go.
They didn't go, when they went to school, administrators, what happened?
They did not pay attention. My daughter, she was in Sethlow. The dean said, oh, that's nothing. And you can't speak with the principal. That's what she told me. And I'm sitting there, are you kidding me? My daughter was attacked, pushed down on these steps in Sethlow, and that's what you're telling me?
So you sent her to...
I took her out. I put her into a private school. I took all my kids out.
But not everybody could afford to do that sort of thing.
And it really frustrated me even more because many of these kids now were looking at law enforcement also as an enemy. Because if you're going to arrest a child in front of his... if you're going to arrest a husband or a father in front of his kid, the kid's standing there and, you know, his father's arrested and he's looking down and the kid's looking at his dad. Is this the land of the free that you brought us to? For you to be arrested, for this happening to you, for nothing else, just because your name matched on somewhere? And that's what the people were going through. They were so afraid. They came crying in my stores. They came crying to my dad. I'm sitting there. I'm like, okay, we got to figure out something. And one thing leads to another, and all these cases. And we kept seeing these stories. We couldn't believe it.
Have the schools improved in their dealing with Muslim kids?
I think that,
especially kids who are wearing hijab?
I think there's more awareness of Muslims in general in New York City by government, by schools. That's certainly true since 9/11. But one of the things that Mr. Azzi mentioned and that he was so focused on back then was the stories that didn't make the papers, not just a hate crime, but the sort of seemingly smaller incidents that were certainly not smaller to the people that were being affected by, you know, people who are facing job discrimination or their landlords were trying to oust them. And the survey he mentioned that he did with the city and a number of other groups was documenting instances of discrimination against South Asians and Muslims after 9/11. He and other folks were going around with these surveys, collecting them, having folks fill them out. And some of the saddest and most disturbing revelations from these surveys were the number of children who were being harassed on the streets, but often in school settings by their peers. And then they would often tell nobody, because that's sort of what happens when you're a child. You just, you know, you're afraid to get any extra attention. You don't want your peers to be looking at you or you about making too much of a fuss. So kids would hold it inside. And that's what, with these surveys, Mr. Razzi was trying to expose and to stop. And I think there was tremendous frustration on the part of many of himself and many other Muslim parents who did try to protect their kids. The sheer frustration and helplessness of being unable to protect your children from so much discrimination and bias and abuse, and then sometimes going to school officials and not getting a sympathetic ear.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Goneman, who has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2015. Her latest article, Neighborhood Watched, is in the current issue of the magazine, and it features, it focuses on the work of Mohammed Razvi, who's also here. He's the executive director and founder of Council of People's Organization, COPO. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You wanted to add to that, Mohammed?
Yeah, so one of the most important things we started was these iftar dinners. And we started with Marty Markowitz in Brooklyn.
Then the borough president.
We started with Marty Markowitz. Then we started with the Manhattan borough president, then Scott Stringer. We started then with Helen Marshall in Queens. And then in Staten Island, I forgot his name. My God, how could I forget his name? So we started these iftar dinners. And then most importantly, we also started iftar dinners with the Bloomberg administration. And this gave such a voice to the Muslim community to be able to sit, break bread, and talk about their concerns.
But interestingly, FBI reported in 2016 that attacks against American Muslims surged in the previous year. 257 reports of assaults, attacks on mosques, and other hate crimes against Muslims. And that was a jump of 67% over 2014. So things slowed down after 9/11, and then they picked up again before Donald Trump became a candidate. You can't blame everything on Donald Trump.
Well, it's also because we were actually making sure people are aware that they need to report, because we found out many people were not reporting, even adults. And that's what this report actually showed after 2003, that people didn't report, and we were focusing on trying to get them to report and holding all these sessions, Knowing Your Rights sessions, with leaders, so that emphasized for them to come out if there is anything happening.
Jennifer, you met Sarah Said, a community activist, who said the government really had little understanding of Muslim communities. She said you had to be a broker, you had to explain our communities to electeds and agencies. Isn't she now a senior advisor to Mayor Bill de Blasio?
She is. I mean, what she's talking about there is 2002, 2003, when Mr. Razi was sort of running around in meetings with this binder full of surveys trying to explain to folks what was going on. The phrase she actually used when I spoke to her about Mr. Razi was she called him a cultural broker, somebody who was trying to bridge two worlds, to try to explain his own community to politicians and vice versa.
Wouldn't it be in the best interest of the FBI and ICE to cultivate good relations with these communities?
Well, that's what we have been doing ever since 9/11, ever since 2003. The FBI requested me to participate in their FBI Citizens Academy program. So when people used to tell me my husband's missing, I used to make phone calls to about almost a dozen jail cells trying to locate them. But after going through the program, I only needed to make one phone call, and I was able to find that person and get them attorneys to represent them. And that's the type of relationship that started to develop.
So have things eased up since it was reported that the NYPD was doing a lot of surveillance in mosques and other Muslim areas?
So at that moment, that was a very difficult time because many people were upset, and many community leaders, when we were having conversations, I was at one of the first meetings with Commissioner Kelly at that time. We brought together community leaders, imams, presidents of organizations, and we sat at the table and we explained to the commissioner, you have to have more meetings and you should have an advisory council to the NYPD. And lo and behold, he started that, he did that. And the relationships that they started to build was even better. And under Police Commissioner Kelly's watch, so many Muslims were enrolled into the NYPD. And that's the key. I mean, at the moment, we're hearing there's close to 1,000 Muslim law enforcement officers at NYPD.
And are they assigned to areas like Little Pakistan?
Absolutely. I just met with a NYPD Sergeant Abbas just yesterday. He came to my office and he was like, oh my God, I'm here. Let me know what you need.
Is the feeling, Jennifer, that certain cities like New York, Los Angeles, perhaps Portland, would have a different attitude about all of this to some of the other parts of the country?
Different attitude about law enforcement, you mean?
Law enforcement and just how to deal with Muslims in this country.
You know, there's so many Muslims in
Texas. Texas just passed that anti-sanctuary city law.
Exactly. There's so many Muslims in New York City now, and Pakistanis is just one part of the Muslim community, which is wildly diverse. But I think the city itself has just gotten so much more educated and informed about Muslims, about how to help, about how to serve, about how to sort of bridge the divides, and is in a much better position now to respond than it was post 9/11.
So you're feeling positive in some ways, Mahmoud?
I'm feeling very positive because even after the ban that was issued by our president, I called for a special meeting with the FBI and Muslim leaders. And immediately we had a meeting and we explained, you know, the concerns of the people that all of a sudden FBI is going to do raids. And clearly within 12 hours, FBI gave a statement that we are not going to do that at all.
Is part of the problem for the Pakistani community that the Taliban has a large presence in Pakistan? Are there suspicions that there might be Taliban activity in New York, in Brooklyn?
Well, let me put it this way. Pakistan is a poor country. Pakistan does not have free educational system. Saudi Arab, with their Wahhabism, came to Pakistan and opened up these madrasas. And in these madrasas, they go to the people in the poor neighborhoods, oh, you can't feed your child, send him to us, we will feed him, we will educate him, and we're going to be teaching him, you know, the religion Islam. But they're teaching
Wahhabism.
Wahhabism, that's what they're teaching. They're not teaching them Islam. So this is what's been happening. And it just, I find, I mean, I'm at loss to why are we dealing with so many things with Saudi Arab, and when they have the Wahhabism that's causing all this, and the attackers were Saudis. Meanwhile, the Pakistanis and all these other South Asian countrymen are being picked up.
You want to add anything, Jennifer, before we end this?
You know, I just wanted to bring it right back to Mr. Khan, who we talked about at the beginning of the show, and about, you know, his deportation proceedings that Mr. Razvi was able to stop back in 2005. You know, I knew his story from Mr. Razvi had told me about it many times. He's got clips in another binder from Newsday from when he was able to stop that deportation, and it's one of his, I'd say, prouder moments, achievements post 9/11. And then as I was finishing up this story for The New Yorker recently, I just stopped by to just triple check a couple facts with him right before we went to print. And he says, "You'll never believe who's about to walk in." And here comes Mr. Khan, Shahid Ali Khan, looking absolutely devastated. And he walks into Mr. Razvi's office. He slumps in a chair, and he started to cry. And he had just come from 26 Federal Plaza, from the ICE office, where he'd done his annual check-in. And every year he would check in and get told to come back the following year. And this year he was told to come back on July 6th. And now he, his wife, and his disabled son faced very serious risk of deportation.
So immediately I actually took out the news article that I had in Newsday. I was scanning it and scanning the young man's thank you card, and I was about to send it out to ICE. Realized that I have to wait to speak with his attorney. And at the moment, I have sent it to ICE. I have explained to them the situation. They said they're going to work on it. ICE is not allowing him to stay. They said they want his passport. So I called the Consul General of Pakistan, Mr. Ejaz, and Mr. Ejaz Ali. Already today, I just got a text message from him that two of the passports, they already have them made, and we're working on the third passport, because we're trying to follow whatever steps need to happen without, let's just say, without any problems.
But this sounds like new territory.
I mean, in some ways, I think folks in Little Pakistan feel like it's 9/11 all over again. But in this particular case, you have a family. The father was a bank manager in Pakistan. He's now driving for Lyft, scraping together a living in Midwood in Brooklyn. I've been here 20 years and yet at serious risk of deportation with a severely disabled son. And obviously, if he's deported, won't be able to get the treatment his son needs back in Pakistan.
I've been speaking with Jennifer Gunnerman, whose latest article for The New Yorker, where she is a staff writer, is called Neighborhood Watched, and with Mohammed Razvi, who is the executive director and founder of the Council of People's Organization. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.